I find that I'm personally leaving.
Well, hello everyone. Yesterday I made a video on Ofcom versus 4chan, or Keir Starmer's government's attempts to regulate 4chan, which created an almighty hullabaloo. Hundreds and hundreds of comments. Lots of people very upset. There were people like, oh, I've been watching you for 10 years. Unsubscribed. Can't believe this. Have you lost your mind, AA? Have you gone mad? V, Romanian V, if you remember him, he made a video called What's Happened to Academic Agent, where he was asking the question, how is it that I went from my libertarian views from 10 years ago to coming out and saying that I support the principle of the government being sovereign in matters like this. And I think such was the hullabaloo that I'm going to do this response both to V and a lot of the comments. So I've actually prepared, look, I've got a list of things I'm going to cover here. One, I want to have a look at the a brief history of censorship in this country, because one of the reoccurring comments was, or one of the comments was, thing is, AA, you just don't understand Anglo-liberty because you're brown. Because you're brown. This was one of the arguments, so I'm gonna tackle that. Second thing I'm going to look at, and the second most common theme, was on where the internet is actually located, okay? And the third thing, and we're going to talk about that, and the third thing was something that V mentioned, where he mentioned Schmidt and the friend-enemy distinction, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Suffice to say that V doesn't quite understand what is meant by Schmidt, and V himself, whether he likes it or not, does not actually escape the friend-enemy distinction in his own politics, and I'll explain more about all of that when we get there. Okay, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, buy it now, the Trivium, and many other great courses available. So, for this first section, where I'm going to be looking at, so part of my argument was that this has always happened with technology. When technology changes, or when the system of communication changes, the regulations then catch up. Okay, and this has basically happened all the way through history, and we're going to have a look at some of the previous efforts of the British government to bring speech, quote-unquote, under control. So in 1545, Henry VIII appointed a master of revels under the Lord Chamberlain to regulate public performances. Well, that was very brown of Henry VIII, wasn't it? Old brown Henry. Not very in the tradition of Anglo-liberty from Henry VIII there. Let's carry on. So this Lord Chamberlain's powers of censorship basically continued. I happen to know this because when I was working on Shakespeare, I was acutely aware of the fact that Shakespeare's plays faced censorship. I mean, his company was actually called the Lord Chamberlain's Men. But every play had to be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain, to the Master of Revels, who would then go through the play and make amendments. This practice continued for a very long time. It continued until 1737, notwithstanding the brief period there where Cromwell actually shut the theatres down and banned Christmas and all the rest of it. But when the theatres reopened, it still came back under the Lord Chamberlain's office. And everything was formalised in 1737 with something called the Licensing Act, which, again, regulated all public performances. And eventually, this was replaced by the Theatres Act in 1843. And these acts were pretty, they were not just restrictive in terms of, you know, certain words they weren't allowed to say, or, you know, in the time of the Tudors, you know, you wouldn't have been able to put regicide on stage, as one example. There's a scene in Richard II where Richard II abdicates. That was reserved only for private performances. On the public stage, they wouldn't have been allowed to put that on. These are just examples of some of the sorts of things. Lewdness of various kinds. Women weren't allowed on stage until the 18th century. But they were also proscriptive. So if you have a look into the Theatres Act 1843, there were guidelines that there has to be kind of like some sort of moral good being pushed and things like this as well. Okay, so there you go. In the tradition of Anglo-liberty, very brown of the Victorians to be behaving like that. Very brown of the Hanoverians, the Georgians, to be carrying on in the way they did. Very brown of Oliver Cromwell to shut the theatres down. And of course, very brown of the Tudors to bring in the Lord Chamberlain's Master of Revels. So all of this continued, basically. The Lord Chamberlain retained these powers over the theatre all the way, you know, under the Theatres Act and so on. It was, you know, brought into what became the modern British state. But it was still the kind of continuation of the Lord Chamberlain's office that regulated the theatre. And it continued all the way until 1968, when leftist radicals abolished these powers. And so public live performances after 1968 were a lot less censored, and you get an explosion of some extreme theatre. Romans in Britain is one of the famous examples, where there's a staging of gay sex, or gay rape even, that occurs in that play. It was hugely controversial at the time. I think since, some censorship has crept back in to the stage, but for a while there, for a brief period in the 70s and the 80s, there was a kind of more anything goes attitude, and it resulted in things like Sarah Kane's Blasted, which famously has a scene where a baby is eaten on stage. Before that, because of the quite strict regulations, the British stage had a lot of innuendos and playwrights like Noel Coward and Terence Rattigan, where there were things left unsaid. And you could argue that it led to a kind of sophistication on the English stage. But other arguments are available. Maybe it was really important for Edward Bond to get his gay rape scene on stage. You know, opinions may vary. We wouldn't want to be too Mary Whitehouse, would we? Oh, sorry, she was brown too. Let's carry on, okay? So you now had this scenario where the live stage that was regulated up until 1968 pretty heavily, then they relaxed censorship, but obviously there was a change in public appetites and public consumption of performances, because the radio and the television became a big thing. And this meant that there needed to be new regulation for those things. But first of all, I should mention that there was something in 1959 called the Obscene Publications Act, 1959. Also under Margaret Thatcher, the famous libertarian, she also brought in the Public Order Act, 1986, okay? And this is kind of interesting stuff. The Obscene Publications Act in 1959 was also subject to live performances. So even though they were getting away with staging like gay rape, there were still certain things that were prohibited under that Obscene Publications Act. So the theatre company could actually get into trouble. Then we get this Public Order Act under Thatcher, which, if you're interested, is the actual root of what is called hate speech today in British law. That term, hate speech, has its root in the Public Order Act of 1986. And, obviously, in Britain, there are strong libel laws and laws of defamation as well. And, of course, if you were putting a play on, your performance would be subject to all of those things too. However, like I said, technology was changing. So you had the telephone, you had the radio, obviously, and then you had the television. And with the advent of these two new technologies, the state had to catch up. So first of all, the new powers of censorship accrued to the Postmaster General. Most significantly, with the Wireless Telegraphy Act of 1904, which regulated communications over the telephone. There were certain things that were prohibited under that act. Then, as television became a thing, the Postmaster General, whose office was called Oftel, was basically... So it started off with telephones. Then the Postmaster General picked up radio as part of his portfolio. Then, as television became a thing, it was stuck in there as well. So this started to be a little bit unwieldy because the Postmaster General was having to make decisions on a post hoc basis. He was kind of de facto in charge of regulating these sorts of communications. So eventually, separate regulators were set up in every area. So one such example is the Independent Television Authority from 1954. Then in 1972, there was a move to consolidate them in one bigger authority called the Broadcast Authority, which had a division for television and a division for radio. Then in 1972, under Margaret Thatcher, so that 1972 Broadcast Authority kind of ballooned in size, and under Thatcher, they wanted to kind of make them smaller again, so they set up the Broadcasting Standards Council in 1988, very brown of Margaret Thatcher to do that, and even more brown of Margaret Thatcher was to set up the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of 1981. And these were all then later merged, so there's this weird thing where they set up these separate entities, and then they're merged, and then they're broken apart again. I don't know why this keeps on happening. But under John Major, in 1996, they put them all together again and made something called the Broadcasting Standards Commission of 1996. So the idea that there was kind of free speech in Britain, that there's this kind of long tradition of anything goes, you're allowed to say whatever you want, not actually true as soon as it becomes anything kind of public. So public theatre, even telephones and telegrams when they came in, radio and television have always been subject to regulation. Things that you are allowed to put on air and things that you're not allowed to put on air. Okay. John Major also split up the IBA to establish a separate radio authority in 1991. Then he set up the Television Commission in 1991 as well. And what Tony Blair did, so we're going to go all the way, this is a long story, to get to Ofcom, who are the body that we're talking about today. What Tony Blair did is he took all of these separate bodies that had been set up over the years. There was the kind of fag end of one from like the 70s. There was these ones that Major set up. There were the ones that Thatcher set up. He said, look, all this is a mess. We're going to take all these separate bodies that are all over the place, you know, and we're going to put them all into one centralized body, and it's going to be called Ofcom. Right? So Blair did not just invent censorship, okay? What Blair did is he streamlined it into one body with government oversight. That's what he did. I mean, Ofcom is meant to be independent, but it's given government guidelines, and the government set certain rules that Ofcom has to stick to, and of course they pass laws that Ofcom have to then enforce. Incidentally, if you're interested, this is, you know, the Equality Act 2010 is also an example of this, where there were lots and lots of different discrimination laws, many of them written by Thatcher, by the way, you know, like the Race Relations Act 65, that wasn't Thatcher, but there was all those different laws on the books, and the Equality Act 2010, what New Labour did is they basically just put them all into one super act, right, so as to, and that's what Blair and Brown did a lot. They had all sorts of different rules everywhere, and they just put them into one super rule. And Ofcom is one of these. What I hope to show with this long history from Henry VIII to Tony Blair is that the British state or the British government has always taken steps to regulate what can and cannot be said in the public. And I would warrant that pretty much every government is the same as a matter of practicality. Of course, they're going to want to have some control over what can and cannot go out in the interests of sensible government. Part of it will be propaganda. Part of it will be security, like war, for example. Lots of censorship comes in during wartime because the enemy is trying to infiltrate. The enemy is trying to get its narrative out there. But there is also just the question of what was always called moral decency or public decency. America had these laws too. Hayes Act in Hollywood is one, and television was a famous one. I remember Ronald Reagan brought in a lot of the TV shows I watched when I was a kid, He-Man and Thundercats and, you know, Transformers. All of those, I remember. Ronald Reagan passed an act where every children's show had to have some sort of moral message, and that's why He-Man at the end of the show would be like, and today's lesson is, kids, don't talk to strangers. You know, it'd be very cheesy stuff like that, but this was actually a government edict from Ronald Reagan. Okay, again, very Brown, very Ronald Reagan didn't understand the tradition of Anglo liberty, and neither did Margaret Thatcher. Okay, so all I'm saying is, once you look at the history of this stuff, you understand that these arguments that people are giving me are not actually in earnest. They're not actually honest arguments, and they're not factual. So let's now come forward to the current case, to the 4chan case and Ofcom. So What they're trying to do at the moment, and it's not just the British government, it's the EU, who've got a version of this, as I mentioned in the last video. It is the American government, who've got, their version is literally called, by the way, the Kids Online Safety Bill, or the Kids Online Safety Act. It is literally, and I'm not kidding you, word for word the same as the British one. And it's already passed in the Senate with 90 plus votes. Okay, it's sitting there waiting for the House of Representatives to pass it. And mark my words, they will pass it. Okay, they'll pass it because the money men, big tech, Larry Ellison and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, they've got tons of money and resources. They can afford the compliance. Big companies always love regulation because they can afford to do it. Little companies or tiny shoestring operations like 4chan, which have only got, as far as I know, 2 employees, don't like regulation because they can't afford it. They literally don't have the manpower to do what the British government wants. Whereas big tech do have that manpower and they can do it. As an example, if I come out here, right, if I came onto my YouTube channel and I just went completely off the rails and I started, I don't know, posting lolly porn, right? Lolly is like anime underage porn. And I'm like, you know, actually, guys, I've decided I just fucking love, you know, kiddie porn. YouTube would just take the video down straight away. They just take it down. Or if it was just like, I don't know, if I started like flashing boobies at you, okay, they'd age restrict the video. Or if the video is too violent, for example, they age restrict it. That is the sort of thing that the British government want 4chan to do. YouTube, because it's run by Google, can afford that because they've got loads of employees and tons of money. 4chan maybe won't be able to. They literally just cannot monitor the amount of stuff that people put on there. Now, I was interested, by the way, because when I mentioned in the last video, hundreds of comments, some people said, yeah, it's true. You go on 4chan and literally people drop porn in all the time. Some of it really quite disgusting. Some of it underage. Other people said, actually, it's not true. The moderators remove that stuff straight away. There is no such thing on 4chan. Okay, now I don't go on 4chan. I don't know what the truth is. All I know is that some people are saying it's there. Other people are saying it's not. What the British government want is for 4chan to be able to prove to them that they are taking every step necessary to make sure that their site is free of that sort of stuff. And what they've said, as I told you, is that if you don't do this, we're going to levy fines on you until such a time as we actually ban you outright, using that as a pretext to ban 4chan outright, or until such a time as you actually comply, in which case. So what is the purpose of doing the fines? What is the purpose of doing it that way rather than unilaterally just banning 4chan? Okay. The reason they're doing it that way is because they're giving 4chan a chance to show that they can be trusted, to show that they can be worked with. Like, that's why they do it. From their own point of view, if the British government just said, right, 4chan's banned, it would be a different sort of, there'd be a public outcry that they were being tyrannical, yada, 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 okay? So what they're doing is they're creating a trail so they can say, look, we gave them every chance possible. They stuck two fingers up at our face. They didn't pay any fines. And now we've got no other choice, but we must take stronger action, lean on the ISPs to get rid of this site, okay? And that's going to bring me... So that's the reason why they've gone down the route of fining first rather than just outright banning or leaning on the ISPs, etc. So this brings me to the main argument that lots of people brought up in the comments, and also the argument that V made in his video, which is... there's two parts of it, right? There's two parts of it. One part of it is that so it seems like in the imagination of a lot of people, if I went on my video, if I went on my computer here, and I, you know, go on my internet, go on my browser, right, I click on 4chan. Incidentally, by the way, 4chan is, a lot of people, and V said this as well, a lot of people in the comments said, oh, 4chan's already blocked in the UK. They decided to do that themselves. That's not true. I can go on 4chan right now. If I type in 4chan into Google, it comes up. I go on there. It's not blocked. It's not blocked in this computer, on that computer, on my 4G. I've tried it from public Wi-Fi when I'm in a cafe or something. 4chan is not blocked anywhere. Okay, so that is just not true. So that's the first thing. But people think that if I go on 4chan here, that's me being transported to Delaware. That when I go on 4chan, I magically, through the magic of the internet, now I'm in Delaware, and somehow all that's happening is that I'm accessing Delaware. that is the argument that everybody's presenting to me. And it's just clearly not the case, is it? If a child accesses a website, they're not magically being transported to Delaware, and nor are you. You are experiencing it. It is happening here. It is happening here in Britain. Therefore, it is being consumed by the British public. And therefore, it is a matter for the British government. It is a nonsense to say, well, because this company is based in Delaware, there's no jurisdiction. It's also a nonsense to say that when I click on that website, I'm a digital tourist travelling to Delaware. Bollocks! That's not what's happening. I am bringing that into my living room. I'm bringing that here. I don't have Delaware in my living room. What I've got is content that is being imported to this country from wherever source. And in any other field, right? So people wanted to make this distinction between the physical world, this pen, for example, the physical world, and the digital world. And that the same laws that apply to physical cannot apply to digital. I don't really understand what distinction people think they're making there. Because in any other field, if a company was lobbying, let's say, pollution, let's say it was a foreign factory that was just pumping smog over, right? Obviously, that company would be then in trouble with the government. Or let's say if a company was just airlifting by helicopter and dropping CDs of child porn into the country, like bombing the country with porn in physical form, clearly the people who did that would be in trouble with the British government. The distinction you guys are trying to make is like, well, because it's digital, because it's online, the same rules don't apply. Why this case? Why this special pleading? Obviously, the British government is going to have an issue. Somebody in the comments said, "Look, if an American publisher did a porn magazine that was being sold in the shops, and it was found that that porn magazine had underage girls in it, which is against the law, that it was had you know pedo porn in it, essentially, obviously the British government would stop that magazine being stocked here." Okay. Now, where the controversy has come is in the decision to actually try to fine 4chan, because people have said, well, because they've taken that step, it's like, and V said this as well, it's like the British government are trying to police the entirety of the world's internet. They're trying to dictate what can be online, okay? That is not strictly speaking true. What they're doing is they're saying this website is not in compliance with British laws. You need to make an effort to make sure that it is. Now, how they could respond is by saying, look, we're going to create a UK mirror of 4chan, or we're going to create a UK version of the site, localized for the country, which doesn't have any of the stuff that you don't like on it, like the lolly. I imagine the problem that the British government have is what they call lolly, which is this, it's basically like manga porn, but it's like manga or anime images, sexual images of girls that are clearly prepubescent, something like this, okay? I think that is what the British government are targeting here. Didn't actually specify what sort of child porn it was, or you know, but that's what I suspect they're after here, okay? So they could actually create a mirror. Now, this is not unprecedented, okay? This is not unprecedented. For example, in 2006, the American government put a ban on many, many different forms of online gambling. It was called like the Online Gambling Act. And gambling is big in Britain. There's a lot of big bookmakers, bookies in this country who were operating in America. And when this came to pass, those UK sites had to put an ISP block on American, or like, i.e., if you try to access those sites from America, you wouldn't be able to do it. They'd be blocked. It says, oh, by order of the American government, this website is not allowed in America. And there was one guy who was actually one online British online gambling company that was caught. Basically, it was available in the state of Louisiana. They took this guy to court. Okay, it's a British guy, owned an online gambling site that people were accessing in Louisiana. It's this guy here that you can... I'll put him on screen. And they said, look, you have broken American laws, online gambling laws, by making this service available in America. We want to take you to court. And they put in an extradition request to the British government, which was accepted. They sent this guy along, and eventually, they let him go, whatever. But the fact is that they tried to get him, and the British government complied, okay? These laws, this Online Safety Act, has been written with the expectation that all of the Western countries will have harmonized laws eventually, okay? They're still in the process of being passed in America and in Europe and in Australia and so on. Britain is a little bit ahead of the curve. But mark my words, when all of these come in, the governments will cooperate with each other in exactly the same way as the British government cooperated with the state of Louisiana over that online gambling case. Okay? These governments, the British government and the American government, cooperate with each other. The notion that the American government is simply going to say, well, like, up yours, Britain, because of patriotism or something, is just nonsense. Or the idea that the American government actually stands... While the British government is communist and totalitarian, the American government actually stands for my liberty. Bullshit. It's not going to. It won't. Let me just tell you something. The regime always telegraphs its moves. I've told you this so many times. It always telegraphs its moves. Back in April, if you typed in 4chan into the news, there were all these articles saying, have you noticed that 4chan is dead? 4chan is dead. Nobody goes on 4chan anymore. 4chan is done. There's been a leak. Nobody trusts it. 4chan is over. It's history. It's ancient. It was great once, but now it's gone. Article after article after article in April were pushing this line that 4chan is dead. It was in April that Ofcom, that the British government, requested 4chan give up that information. It was in April that they did that. And now they've ramped it up even more. So it's obvious that the powers that be, which is all of them, not just the British government, all of the so-called... they always work in concert, these people. They always work together across the Five Eyes and across the 14 Eyes, as they call them, across all of the European powers. They all bring it in at the same time. And they're doing it right now. So the notion that there's going to be some, like, oh, that... It's going to be USG to the rescue of 4chan is a fantasy. It's just a nonsense. It's slop, is what it is. And I'm asking you to get real for once. Get real for once. So there's that. I think I've covered that. I'll tick it off my list here. One little thing I'm just going to insert here is that just before I recorded this, I saw that the British government is now actually going after VPNs, and they're going to put pressure on Apple to ban VPNs from the App Store and basically make VPNs a lot harder to come by. It's just a little coda here. Finally, there's this video that V made where he said, oh, I was buddies with an academic agent once. I used to call him ANCAP agent. That's true. But now, you know, since he started talking about Carl Schmitt, I don't watch him anymore because I don't like the ideology of Carl Schmitt, friend and enemy. You've got to understand what friend and enemy is, okay? It is not a prescription. It is not an ideology. It is a description of what politics is. Politics is the battle, is the, in essence, between friend and enemy. That is what Schmitt is saying. The politics distilled down is just between friend and enemy. Now, V, I know enough about V, and I've seen enough of his recent stuff to know that he hasn't changed much. Doesn't like people telling him what to do. V wants to be left alone to grill. He doesn't like any power, be it communist or be it of the Mary Whitehouse variety, like moral fagging, he calls it, of the kind of Christian variety, telling him what to do. He doesn't want restraints or curbs on his personal liberty. This is V's basic position. That as long as it doesn't go outside his bedroom, right, what harm is it doing? This kind of attitude. And that's fine. But this, which is the attitude of a lot of people, like a default libertarian, if you want to put it this way, a default civil libertarian. Or even simpler, a liberal. This does not actually escape the friend-enemy distinction. Liberalism basically is the desire to escape politics. Okay? It's the kind of fantasy that you can ever get outside of somebody trying to tell you what to do, government, friend-enemy distinction. So the liberal hates the idea of friend-enemy because the liberal wants nothing else than to escape politics or the political. But V does not escape the political because by distinction of the very stance that he has to count the communist as an enemy, and he does. And he also has to count the fascist as an enemy, which I'm sure he does too, because the fascist also wants to tell you what to do. And he has to count the kind of any kind of Christian authoritarian regime or any kind of Christian regime that would place limits on what he's allowed to do. He'd have to count them as an enemy. And he, I know from V's own work, he counts the social justice warrior, you know, the woke, as we call them, they're his enemy because they place limits on what he's allowed to do. So, what's changed? What's my stance? Well, at some point, you have to realise that there is no outside of this. There is what V wants, I'm afraid to say, is a fantasy. It is almost childish to think that you could ever get away from people trying to tell you what to do. I'm very independent myself. I don't like being told what to do. Almost pathological about it. I just don't take well for people. I don't like being pushed around. Nobody likes being pushed around. Nobody likes feeling limits on what they're allowed to do. And yet, human government always places limits on what you're allowed to say or do. And it's not a brown thing and an Anglo thing, as some people seem to think. This is just what governments do. So, once you come to peace with the fact that there's always going to be a government, you then have to say, well, it comes down to wanting my friends in government and not my enemies in government. Just so happens that at the moment it's our enemies in government. I would love it to be our friends. And once you come to peace with this fact, it's not actually this big scary thing. V just looks at Carl Schmitt and he says, oh, this looks scary. I don't want to look at that because he was a, you know, he was involved with the mid-century Germans. And that's scary. I'm not allowed to do that. That's enemy. I can't do that. Ironically. But actually, what Carl Schmitt is saying is that there's just, you just can't escape this. You just cannot escape it. So then you have to ask yourself, I mean, V has to ask himself, who is in power right now? Are they our friends or are they our enemies? And I don't really see what in particular V would have against that idea. This is just kind of life. I don't really see why it's this kind of big scary thing that would cause somebody to switch off. But some people did. And you see, this is a thing, because I'm not actually that bothered. People come and go. People come and go in life. If he watched for a while and then he didn't watch, so be it. If you watched for a while and then you didn't watch, so be it. What can I do? You know, I put my stuff out, grateful for the people who watch it. If you watch for a period, I'm happy for that. If you stop, I also don't care. Because I have no control over it, have I? I've got no control over that. So it's pointless to spend time worrying about things over which one has no control. So anyway, that is a kind of longer response to a lot of the people who had problems with my stance on the Ofcom. I think a lot of people have looked at this in a kind of disingenuous way, where it's stripped of context. So people were saying, oh, this is a little bit like North Korea trying to place demands on South Korea. It's not. It's not like North Korea and South Korea, because the British government and the American government are allies. They always work together and have done since 1945. They always work in concert, hand in glove. The EU and the UK also always work together. They're all part of NATO. The way regulation has worked is that they've tried to harmonize. What they're trying to do is create a grid, a system that is distinctly the system of, I guess you'd call it, the West. It's like when you go on the iPhone and you're in the little app store, or you're on Netflix. This is a kind of like little containment zone where it's regulated and trustworthy companies are, looking over stuff to make sure it's quote unquote safe. That's the dream. That's what they're trying to bring about. And what I think a lot of people missed, and I did say it, even though I said it, doesn't seem to matter, is that even though I don't like this law, I don't actually like the Online Safety Act. The principle of governments being able to say what goes is probably more important in the long run than the alternative, which is the situation where it's left up to private companies. Because it wasn't that long ago, was it, that private companies, Twitter, as one example, a private company, and Facebook and YouTube, banned the President of the United States. Do you remember that? Do you remember when they banned Trump? So on balance, really, I would say you probably want it to be up to the government rather than the private companies. I wouldn't really be that against some sort of legislation making it, the internet, into some sort of public utility, which I think, something like that will probably happen at some point. That's what happened in the case of telecoms. You know, that was all private at one point, and then at another point they were like, right, we're going to nationalize all this stuff now. It's a public utility. And then they privatized it again. And then they privatized it again. I could see arguments along those lines. I'm not really up for it. Don't forget now, most of us aren't up for globalism, right? People talk about globalism, right? But if you say that none of the national governments have any power to dictate certain things, in essence, what you're saying is there should be just one world internet. One world. So this is the dream. This is the kind of utopian dream of the original Silicon Valley guys. Just one internet without any hierarchy. Everybody, you just... anything goes. Anything goes. If I want to watch my... I want to consume my lolly on 4chan, who are you to stop me? Is this really what we want? If we look at the history of the censorship, can you really say that the abolition of some of those censorship laws was for the good in the long run? Serious. Did anybody benefit from watching like the gay rape scene after they abolished they relaxed the on-stage censorship? It's a genuine question. What was the benefit of removing the Hays Act in America? Has it been good for society? Or has it made society more degenerate, more sexualized, more kind of, you know, debased? Genuine question. So I don't know, like, all of a sudden everybody is like an ideologically committed to, you know, an anything goes non-censorship environment. Is that really what people want? Why? Don't you want standards? These are all genuine questions. You tell me what your views are. All right, I think that'll do. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, buy it now, and I'll catch you next time. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.